We're going to continue our discussion of decision analysis. Last time we talked about type 1 and type 2 error, and there's a kind of naive approach of just looking at results and saying, well, if you experience very few defaults and other people's, you know, seemingly risky loans performed well, then you must have been stupid and made a lot of type 2 errors. And then if on the other hand, if you made loans that resulted in a lot of defaults, then you must have been stupid and made a lot of type 1 errors. Let's see if we can take a kind of a less naive approach. And suppose that we have a risk measure, such as a credit score, and we have a bunch of loans that defaulted and loans that didn't default. And let's say that the loans that defaulted kind of look like this in terms of the risk measure, and the loans that didn't default kind of look like that. So this is sort of, in some sense, the percent of the of loans, or it's a like a frequency distribution of loans. And this is the risk measure. So again, it could be a credit score, but with, and let's just say that that this is, let's see, if these are the ones that defaulted a lot, then, well, let's say these are the ones that defaulted. So these are the defaults, and these were the loans that performed. So we're looking back at a bunch of loans. These are loans that performed, these are loans that defaulted, and this is a risk measure where in this direction it's higher. So so it could be based on a credit score, but I think better to be a comprehensive measure that combines credit score, loan to value ratio, and other features that you would find in the loan file. So what this tells us is that our defaults tended to have higher risk by this measure. Let's say we had it was a measure that went from, that goes from 1 to 10. So let's say the default center around, let's say, 7, and the performing loans center around 3. What this illustrates is a fairly good separation between defaults and performing loans, but it's not a perfect separation. And what that means is you cannot eliminate all errors. If you set your, so let's say you set your decision criteria to have very few defaults. Let me just stretch this over here. So if you want to have very few defaults, then maybe you want to set your risk measure here, let's say at 3.5. And you say anything over 3.5, I'm going to reject that loan because I don't want to have a probability of default above this small little level. So what does that mean in terms of, so that means you have very few type 1 errors, but it means that among the good loans here, you're going to be rejecting a lot. You're going to be rejecting everything over here, and a lot of those, as you can see, will perform. So when you have very few type 1 errors, you have a lot of type 2 errors. And the relationship depends on the ability of your risk measure to separate the defaults from the performing loans. And the folks at Fair Isaac who did credit scoring used to talk about a Kolmogorov-Smirnov, or a KS measure of separation. If you have a lot of separation, so that there's hardly any overlap in your risk measure between the defaults and the non-defaults, the defaults and the performing, so you have very little overlap, that means you can set your approval-denial boundary somewhere in here and make very few mistakes of either sort. So this is good separation, and it suggests that you have very good very refined risk measurement criteria. The opposite would be bad separation, where there's very little difference between, on the risk measure beforehand, between the loans that subsequently default and don't default. So you could have something that looks kind of like this, in which case no matter where you set your boundary to approve or deny, you're going to make a lot of errors. If you set the boundary way over here, then you're going to make an awful lot of type 2 errors. You're going to miss a lot of these performing loans. You're going to reject an awful lot of performing loans. If you set the boundary way over here to try to get more of those performing loans, then you're going to get a huge percentage chunk of defaults. So this is bad separation, and it's a problem. And one of the things about the risk measurement in mortgages, and this has especially been led by the credit scoring phenomenon, is that people can in fact measure the amount of separation they have. And so they can say, they can see what the, you know, how good their underwriting criteria are for various types of loans. For example, an important example is lending to minority borrowers. So with a credit score, the way that credit scoring proponents like to focus on it is a credit score is an appropriate tool for minority borrowers if you see this kind of separation between good borrowers and bad borrowers among minorities as well as among white people. Where and so if you see that separation, then you should need not ask or should not worry about how many black or white borrowers the scoring system approves. If it happens to reject a lot of minority borrowers because a lot of minority borrowers show up as being way over here in the risk score, then the argument is that's fair. They actually, as long as this truly shows that they have high probability of default, that's fair if it happens that they have they score high on this risk measure. On the other hand, if you had something like this, then the risk measure becomes sort of arbitrary. You're not really separating out good borrowers from bad borrowers. And I'll leave it to the credit scoring proponents to produce statistics defending their results with minority borrowers and showing that they achieve fairly good separation, but that certainly is their claim. Another important thing to emphasize is the distinction between sort of history and the future. If you look over any period of history to get your idea of how the risk measure predicts default, you may get very good separation, but you may not get a good prediction of the future. That is, you seem to have good separation over a historical period, and it says that, wow, if it looks like we could set our risk measure, let's say at 4, and if anything above 4 we reject, and anything below 4 we accept. But the history might include good economic conditions. So there were a lot of appreciation of house prices, incomes going up, and so you set that risk threshold. And sure enough, the separation remains the same in the future, but the default rate at this 4.0 hypothetical thing, instead of being, let's say, 1%, is 8%. So you've separated the good loans from the bad loans. That's the good news. But the bad news is that you might have estimated your default probability based on a period of history where that was very favorable to lending, and you then made the decisions and you had outcomes, the future, that was very unfavorable to lending, and so you had large losses. So the moral of the story is that risk has a relative component. So a relative component, which tells you at any given time, sort of one loan versus another can be measured in terms of risk. So one loan versus another, we can have this risk measure like the one we've been pretending to have, such as a credit score. I'll put a credit score as an example of a... But again, I want to go beyond credit score to include loan-to-value ratio and everything else we can use. We can always measure one loan relative to another and be fairly accurate. But the absolute level of risk depends on future economic conditions. And that's primarily house prices. I'm going to actually make sure I write LTV in here because I don't want to make it sound like everything boils down to credit score. And again, there are other factors. So maybe I'll just put a dot, dot, dot. And maybe I'll put a dot, dot, dot after house prices. So you have both this relative thing, which presumably doesn't change too much over time, then this absolute, which does, and the risk that's involved in mortgage lending has both this relative and absolute component. So even if you have the right criteria for analyzing relative risk, so you have really good, really effective measures in here, you can still make decisions that prove to be wrong if they were based on wrong assumptions about future economic conditions. And what seems to happen with, especially with something like credit scoring, is if you go through a period of, let's say, 5 years where the economic conditions were fine, it begins to look as though you should be loosening up your relative risk criteria on credit scores, because when you take riskier loans, they still pay off during good economic times. So it's very difficult, it seems, to remember that it's future economic conditions, and there's a tendency to overinterpret or overly rely on past economic conditions, or especially recent economic conditions, in evaluating the risk method. So just keeping track of this sort of relative versus absolute risk is very important, and it's one of these things that's poorly understood, and what you get is sort of pro-cyclical criticism from politicians. I'll just repeat that when times were good and the economic conditions had been good, it looked as though lenders were too risk averse, and so politicians said, you know, you ought to be approving more of these loans. We got to, you know, get more people into home ownership. And then conditions turned around, and politicians said, why did you approve those loans? You knew those people couldn't pay. So, and that to me represents a big misunderstanding of the role of relative and absolute risk. And so that's why I emphasize that in this decision analysis.